This is Aspire, Arch Street Public Radio, broadcasting interviews from our Innovate podcast series. In today's episode, Philip Thomas sits down with Ian Fisk, the executive director of the Mentor Capital Network, a group of more than 1,000 individuals who have built, managed, invested in, or studied social enterprises. In that capacity, he has supported hundreds of up-and-running companies who are changing the way the world does business.
Hello, Ian. Thank you so much for joining us, and we're excited to have you here. So let me ask with a million-dollar question. Why are you involved in social enterprise? What was it that got you interested in this and dedicate your time, resources, and life to it?
I grew up in Cape Cod, Massachusetts, and the family business was a boatyard. And my father was a craftsman. I mean, he was a teacher during the winter. And my mother was an accountant. So they were a great partnership because he provided the craft and she provided the business knowledge. I'm pretty sure she could have also built a boat, but she never wanted to do that to show him up. So I learned business from my mother. I worked for my mother, I guess the legal age would be 13. So from sometime a couple of years before it was legal to work. And she did a couple of things that were good for the community and good for business. And by the time I realized this, I was older. I'm precocious, but I'm not that precocious. But I figured out that my mother had decided to run the business in a way that she could take the long-term view. So we lived next to the boatyard, and it turns out if you like your house and you live next to a business, and that business involves 18-wheeler trucks showing up from time to time, you want to be able to keep running that business while you're living there.
Yes.
So one of the things that she did is she stayed open in the winter.
Wow.
So by keeping four or five people, we built boats over the winter. Most of the other boatyards closed down because, amongst other things, you know, there was ice on the water. This is New England, right? And what happened then is the locals loved us. I started to realize that we got a lot of referral businesses. There were other boatyards in the area that were just as good as us. But because we were open year round, we got a lot of referral business. And the tourists come in, they want to buy their boat, get their boat fixed, get their sailing lessons. They ask the people pumping their gas or waiting the tables, who at least at the beginning of the season are locals.
Right.
And when I realized that she had found a way, because she was thinking in the long term, to use the business to benefit the community in a way that made good business sense, I got addicted to this when I was a teenager. I spent the 1990s as a community organizer, sort of going door to door and working for nonprofits and doing leadership development and youth development and engaging communities that weren't being reached out to, that weren't being engaged with. And one of the things I noticed was that for a lot of the boys that I was working with and seeing, young boys, their only positive adult, usually male role models were the janitors at the schools. And I spent a lot of time working with the DC schools in Ward 7 and 8. And so I decided that I wanted businesses to be open near the schools so that folks could see adults working regular jobs. I mean, those people existed, they're wonderful, they're out there, but there just weren't that many of them that were visible to the kids. You could watch them following the janitors around, right?
Like
the,
yes,
the little, right, their role model. There were a few male teachers, but not that many. So before I delved into real estate and business development, I figured I should go to business school. I'd run a couple of small consulting shops and boutique firms and all of that. But if I was going to work on a larger scale and play with other people's money, I should probably have some paperwork. So I went to business school and I came out the other side in economic development and community development finance, essentially nonprofit banking.
Sure.
And was on the path towards what I was just talked about when a group called Wall Street Without Walls found me. Wall Street Without Walls, founded by a guy named John Nelson and Greg Stanton. John knew all the players, and so what would happen is John would find an interesting and complicated project, and Greg would find people in economic development, and Greg would find people who understood the finance at such a high level they could help the nonprofit make it happen.
Right.
And my job for them was essentially chief of staff And, you know, I'd walk into a room and the two of them would be like, we could do this and this and this and this. They'd have like 17 ideas on the wall. And my job was to be like, pick three. I don't care which three. And then find the right people around the world using Greg's name and Rolodex in the beginning, but actually my own.
Yeah.
Who had solved this problem before, who had addressed it, and put them on a phone call and put them in contact with the nonprofit or the community bank or the folks who were trying to do foreclosure mitigation or rebuilding. And during this time, John had started with his friend Chuck Dell a group called the William James Foundation, which they initially wanted to be a business plan competition for corporate social responsibility. And I was the guy that John knew was doing work with small business sustainability. So in addition to the big picture, having grown up in a small business, I was still interested in how do you get small businesses at the startup phase or even lifestyle businesses to think for their community and their corporate bottom line. And so they brought me in. A couple of years later, two things happened, one of which is they ran out of money. And the other, which is I realized that just picking winners wasn't actually helping. And so I took it over the first couple of years as a side project to my work with Wall Street Without Walls. And then when Wall Street Without Walls got smaller during the financial crisis, I tried to figure out, all right, I've got these small companies, these startup companies who want to do good as part of how they do business. My personal agenda is not, if you're giving 20% back to charity, personally, I applaud you. Professionally, I don't care. Because it's not a model that's going to scale. But if you've figured out a way that reduces employee turnover, that de-risks the environment, that addresses markets other people are ignoring, there's so many ways where you can make your business stronger in a way that makes the world a better place. I want to help. And particularly, if you are passionate about your expertise, whatever, you know, you can turn algae into fuel. You can professionalize midwives in Chiapas. You can hire women in northern Iraq. You can do all sorts of things that you're good at that, but running the business is not necessarily your strong point, or it's not your strong point yet.
Sure.
Those are the folks that we help.
So, you know, you talked about, you know, being a winner doesn't help, but obviously, you know, I'm assuming, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you mean winners in the typical business sense. If you could help us understand how you would look at someone who may have the potential to be a winner in the social entrepreneurship spectrum.
Say 100 people apply to a business plan competition and 97 of them get nothing except thank you for entering, and 3 of them get small to medium sized checks and a little bit of publicity. The amount of time spent by all 100 companies in aggregate is less than the value generates who won. So as a net positive to the field, from the point of view of business plan competitions, if all you're doing is identifying the top company out of 100 or 200 or these days 1,000 applicants, that's not a value add to the world. And maybe you've got a $1 million prize like Rice or Hull, but then you're still skirting it because the amount of hours put in by everybody else is low. So what we did is we looked for ways to add value to all of the companies we were working with. So we still get a lot of applicants to whom we don't do anything, but we make the application process very, very easy. So you could apply using an application to somebody else's program. It's a super simple document. We don't want people spending a lot of time on paperwork. I want people running their company. But once you've applied, about a third of the companies have become sort of semifinals. And then about 10% of the companies are actually accepted into the program. Both of these folks, we provide some value to. So it's a little bit of feedback for the semifinalists. And then for the 10% of the companies that end up submitting their business plans to us, everybody gets an average of 20 to 30 pages of feedback. Everybody gets the opportunity to connect with the reviewers. So in essence, what we run is a dating service. I've been doing mentoring work for about 20 or 25 years. And what you want to do is you want to build a relationship. You want to build a connection. And our reviewers are folks who have built, managed, invested in multiple bottom line companies. It's more than 1,000 folks around the globe who know what it is to build a company that has a social, environmental, and financial mission. Thank you.
This episode of Innovate is brought to you by 19th Street Press and Queen of Angels, the debut novel from David Castro. Queen of Angels contrasts Shakespeare with gritty, profane 70s New York. Not only is the novel a compelling exploration of young love, it's a gripping piece of storytelling, says Publishers Weekly. Queen of Angels by David Castro from 19th Street Press.
So within this understanding, you know, of the mission, a big part of it, it seems to be, is there is a certain narrative that is being developed with the entrepreneur. How do you help people understand that narrative? Because it seems, and I applaud your efforts in doing so, sometimes there are people who are good at one thing, maybe not at the other, kind of using as your parents' example. But a big part of the mentorship must be in understanding that narrative. How do you identify people who can understand the narrative, and what are the qualities of people who understand that narrative well enough to help?
So now the answer is peer-to-peer. So we've been doing this for 13 years. A pretty significant, almost a majority at this point, number of our reviewers slash mentors are past participants, are entrepreneurs who have built companies that are still up and running. Founders want to meet other founders.
Right.
And founders love meeting founders who are trying to solve the same problems, but these are for-profit companies, so there is a little bit of competition going on, sometimes a lot.
Sure.
And so because we work internationally, with the exception of software, which of course knows no borders, for most of these companies, we can find them people who are trying to solve the same problems they are, but in a non-competitive space. And so we connect them as, sometimes it's mentor, sort of the traditional sort of senior, junior kind of mentor, but sometimes it's peer-to-peer, like they learn from each other.
So, you know, obviously throughout your time in social entrepreneurship, you've seen its evolution. You've been noticing its evolution from the ground floor up. How has it changed since Mentor Capital started? And would you also just tell our listeners one success story that is, I don't want to call it your favorite because that would, you know, mean forcing you to show a bias, but something that would kind of inspire our listeners.
So one of the changes we've seen over the past 15 years, we see a lot of off-grid power and water and health projects, right? So we see a lot of folks who are developing a device that is, you know, the solar lamp is the traditional one. There are several other, you know, clean water, helping women not have to walk all the way to the river, sanitation, lots of devices that make people's lives better. And I've seen sort of a five-stage process. So in the beginning, 15 years ago, the pitch was about the device. Do you know D-Light?
Yes.
So I actually was on the judging panel that gave them their first business plan competition win that they took down to Sand Hill at Stanford. And so that was about, here's a device. It's much more efficient than kerosene in a tin can, right? And you're right. Then a couple years later, when the devices sort of everybody can make a solar lantern or clean water, whatever, then it became, here's a device and here's how we actually get it to the people who need it. Then a couple of years later, and all of these overlap, so right, so we saw all five things I'm about to tell you, I saw all the time, but they definitely were mostly happening in this particular order that I'm reading to you. So one was device, two was distribution, three was let's make sure that we are making the device that the individual wants to use, right? So the whole principles of design thinking, build the device around the end user, and make sure that it's something that the individual is actually going to engage with. And, you know, the D School at Stanford or Heather Fleming or Mike North, there's a number of people doing amazing work in this area. Four started to become, all right, we've taken into account the individual. Now let's take into account the entire community and the effects it's going to have. The classic example being there's a lot of products which are designed to save time for women. So in there are many parts of the world where the women have to walk out to collect firewood or water. And so there are pretty easy products that make this easier. But it turns out this is the only time in some of these communities where the women actually get to talk to each other. So how do you deal with a power structure, particularly, you know, the men, how do you deal with the whole community, not just the individual who's going to use the product, but the people who are going to be affected by the social implications of that product? Now, the most recent trend, so all of these things sort of pile on each other like a Gantt chart. The most recent trend is the grid is coming. So 15 years ago, I could have done an off-grid power thing on the assumption that none of the people living in the village ever thought there would actually be an electrical hookup. It's coming, right? So Africa and India and rural South America are electrifying fairly rapidly. And when you put a system into a village, you should be able to hook that system into the grid when it shows up, or you've just got a 2 or 3 year lifespan. So designing products on the assumption that you're off grid today, but that you're going to have to be part of the grid in 3 to 5 or 6, whatever years. So that's the most recent trend that I've seen. Now, this is just in the area of dealing with rural populations in light, water, heat, et cetera.
Now,
you asked for success story.
Now, the success, exactly. A success story that, you know, that you've seen within your network that we could use as an inspiration to some of our listeners.
So one of my favorite entrepreneurs is a gentleman named Haywood Hall. And Haywood runs a company called PaceMD. He conveys public health information to people who are not necessarily fully literate. He's very good at that. And he trains people how to do it. He's trained more than, he and his team have trained at this point more than 35,000 people. Haywood was a jazz drummer, and then he saw disco coming. He's a little bit older than I am. And he decided to become an emergency room surgeon, as you do, right? And he's always had very strong roots in community organizing. And when we met him, he was professionalizing midwives in Chiapas. So he was reaching out to women who were highly skilled first responders, but who didn't necessarily read and write technical documents, right? So he could convey information to them, and then he could get the mostly male medical establishment to trust the midwives, because many of the male doctors thought that they were faith healers. And he could get the midwives, only some of whom were faith healers, not as many as the doctors thought, to trust the doctors. And so he's solving three problems. And we paired him with somebody in the Bronx who was doing a similar project with high school dropouts teaching them clean energy projects. And they were doing the same thing. They're conveying technical information and then getting society to trust them and them to trust society. Haywood knew how to do the thing that he did, right? We were never going to teach him anything about public health, nor were we even going to try. But Haywood was not a natural business person. Now, he'd been through a couple of programs. We met him through Agora, but he'd been in a Ashoka Fellow and all of that. But they'd been focused on him as an individual. But between Agora and our people, so this was a partnership with Agora. They also did great work with him. He has learned to build a business structure to the point where he has been taking on larger and larger and larger projects. I mean, 35,000 people trained. He's doing some country-level projects in Mexico around public health and palliative care. And he is now able to use his skill set and deploy it as a business, whereas previously he was the smart guy in the room. Now he's the smart guy in the room who has a fully functioning business that he can deploy to make his ideas happen. And he's someone who's passionate about his expertise, and he's open to and understands that other people should run the business for him.
Now, when we talk about social entrepreneurship, some of our listeners are those who are in it, and then there are many who are actually considering it. What's the one or two words of advice that you would give to someone who might be considering social entrepreneurship?
So my advice, so as someone who teaches social entrepreneurship at universities from time to time, 90% of the class is how to start a business.
Yes.
There's other things to take into consideration, but first you have to be a successful entrepreneur, and then you add the level of complexity of solving a social, environmental, or cultural challenge, right? So people who look at social entrepreneurship as the soft stuff, I kind of resent that, because we're actually doing everything the mainstream folks are doing, and we're trying to solve something else. The main thing I give to any entrepreneur advice is look for the problem you want to solve. Find the thing that you're passionate about. Don't just, if you want to be a social entrepreneur just to, because it's trendy or because it feels like the right thing to do, be a social entrepreneur because there's a problem you want to solve and social entrepreneurship is the way to solve it. If you want to work for somebody else or work in the space until you find your problem, that's fine. I think Vilcap is hiring and I'm not, but I think Unreasonable is hiring, and there's plenty of places where you can get jobs in the space now that you couldn't 15 years ago. But don't start something until you're passionate about that being the thing you want to solve. So many of the entrepreneurs, I mean, I work with folks, and they want to do good things for the planet and the people, but they're like, they're telling me what they do in 2 minutes in, and I understand the problem they're trying to solve, but I have no idea about their business fundamentals, right? If we're 30 to 60 seconds into a conversation about your business and I don't know what you do and who pays you for it and why, I'm a little bit concerned, right? Like, we're going to do this and this and this. Who is going to give you money to solve that problem? What is your business fundamentals? And why is that problem important? And sometimes why that problem is important is hard, but know the problem you want to solve. Also, one of the things is, do you know the most common attribute of successful entrepreneurs in the United States? Family money. Now, I don't mean top 1%. I mean top 20%, right? Or 20-25%. So, for example, my parents paid for my public university, so I'm in that top 25%, right? This doesn't mean that I have friends and family who would necessarily invest $100,000 in my prototype, but it means that I have somebody in my social circle who can speak to money on my behalf. I mean, I do now because I'm 25 years into my career. But when I was starting, the family money, the fact that I was of a certain social class, I mean, everybody, you have to be hardworking and lucky, but that does not actually mean that you are successful. People are like, I'm harder working. No, if you're successful, the odds are very high that you were hardworking. But let me introduce you to lots of people who are also hardworking that weren't successful. It's very difficult to be successful and not be hardworking, but it's not a complete correlation to me. So having somebody in your social circle who can connect you to investors or to professionals who speaks their language. And this kind of connection, when we connect folks to mentors and advisors, this is why we're doing it, right? A lot of our entrepreneurs, yes, we'll take what we call the Harvard and Stanford kids. They apply, they're great, they're very smart, they have amazing ideas. Privilege does not make you a bad person. It's what you do with it, right? But we seek out the folks who don't have that access. And 13 years in, this is not something we could have done 10, 12 years ago, but now it is. Our best resource are the other entrepreneurs. So the people working in a community, you say, there's this person trying to start this thing because we see them working and they're in our community and they're trying to do a different thing for the same people. And that's how we find the entrepreneurs now. So net impact is still helpful, but that's what we're really doing is we're looking out through entrepreneurs who are on the ground telling us about their partners and the people they're working with. And those are the folks we find. And they're, be passionate about the problem you want to solve and have a network of people who you can learn from and who you can connect to and who can connect you to other resources.
Ian, thank you so much for taking time to speak with our listeners. We at Innovate want to wish you and your organization all the best in everything you do, and we're so glad to have you impact the world.
Thank you for joining us today. Our library of interviews and a range of further resources are available at our website, innovatepodcast.org. Aspire and Innovate are produced in partnership with Ashoka, Innovators for the Public, the Kellogg Fellows Leadership Alliance, the Philadelphia Social Innovations Journal, and by Arch Street Press for PRX, the Public Radio Exchange.